You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Avik Jing Chotlani is a translator. He worked for El País. His new book is This Country Is No Longer Yours. Thank you for joining me, Avik.
It's really great to be with you, Rick. And for all of the younger writers out there, I felt pretty dumb reaching out to Rick, thinking that, you know, he's a big shot. He's got thousands of interviews under his belt. And surprisingly, he answered back. And so, you know, whenever you're trying to pitch someone or talk to someone, just give it a shot, because you never know if a big dude will reach back out to you or a big lady in the industry.
I hardly count as a big name, but be that as it may, your book really interested me. And it's a really fascinating look at essentially, you know, I just finished reading kind of a fantasy novel before this about the regions next to hell. And when I read your book, it felt a lot like a fantasy or a dystopia. And I thought, wow, the world's getting worse every day.
Yeah. You know, I find that there's like a fascination. There's sort of two extremes that I see a lot of, whether it's in literature or in popular culture, because, you know, literary novels are not exactly always in popular culture. There's either a fascination with like opulence, the great times, you know, extreme success, victory, these champion countries doing all these things. And then there's this other extreme, which is on apocalypse. And whether it's with zombie movies, or you see it with, you know, even right now with the bombing of Gaza, or a few years ago, the bombing of Yemen, people would refer to it as apocalyptic. And for some reason, when it comes to making something artistic or literary, I find the apocalyptic part kind of perverse, because we still have man-made apocalypses. There are also natural ones, like, you know, Hurricane Katrina or whatnot. But even that, you know, these things can be fixed by proper policy, and they're not. So there's a lot of this man-made apocalypse. And then at the same time, there is, it kind of gets boring to see all this success and victory and cheering and, you know, Super Bowl. It gets a little bit that rah-rah energy kind of, for someone like me, my energy kind of goes down when I see that. So I like to work on the precipice a little bit. I like to work between, you know, the society on the verge of collapse, people quietly leaving the country, the fragility, the silence. I think that there's more interesting things in that silence and that kind of that tension. I think from a human standpoint, it's also quite horrible to live in that kind of a place. But from an artistic standpoint, I think that that's something where it's very rich to be in. There's a lot that can be mined there.
You know, your book has a really interesting structure and feel. Well, unlike anything I've actually ever read, in that it feels like a really excellent dream journal. I provide music for a show called The Dream Journal in my copious spare time. And this feels like, a series of nightmares from different perspectives, drifting through, like, mostly the continuing collapse of Peru. One of the things I find that's interesting about your book is that there is no bottom. Yeah. Everything, yeah. When you think things can't get worse, they do in a different way.
Yeah. And actually, well, most of your listeners, if they know of Peruvian literature, they'll know of Vargas Llosa, Mario Vargas Llosa, who is sort of he's our Nobel Prize winner, and he's a magnificent novelist, and he just wrote his last book, or what he's declared to be his last book. And he had a saying that when he ran for the presidency of Peru in 1990, he's mentioned very briefly in my novel, in This Country's No Longer Yours, and he said underdevelopment is bottomless. And I think that that really matches what you just said. And I think that when you've sort of described it as nightmares, I think that this is something that you've accurately described, and I hope that readers see as well, that this is more, even though I'm a historian by training, I haven't attempted to write a history book. I have attempted to write more of a history of madness or a history of violence and a history of, you know, nightmares in real life. And that's you kind of grasped it. I think that when my agent, she's also a writer, Mariah Stavel, when she pitched this with me, unfortunately, a lot of the publishing houses did not see it that way. They were not able to kind of, they kept trying to tie it to something very tangible happening in the present. And I feel that when you're looking at things like violence, you're looking at things like, you know, chaos and terror, you can't really do that. You do have to kind of accept that you have to kind of let go a little bit of that deep realism. Because, you know, fortunately, these are not the most common occurrences in every single country at all times. Yeah.
On the other hand, one of the reasons that I contacted you was that, you know, you sent me an email that with the subject line, "This country is no longer yours." I thought, well, that's a sentiment I can get behind.
Yeah.
And I'm in, the capital of the capital of the world, you know, in America. We're beyond the first world.
Yeah.
And our sensibility and our understanding of what normal life is almost alien to much of the world. And yes. So, but we are not far from that. I mean, the idea that so many Americans are like one paycheck away from bankruptcy and living on the streets,
yep,
is an idea that, in a sense, I think is intellectually shared by your book. The characters in your book are, you know, like one paycheck away from a horrific civil war that seems to engulf them without ending. And let's just talk a little bit about Peru.
Yeah.
It's a country, you know, I must say, before I read your book, about the most I knew about it was, you know, ancient aliens and the...
The Nazca Lines,
that was about it. And yeah. I had heard the name Fujimori before. Yes. And, you know, wondered, well, what the heck was he doing there? And
yeah.
I think one of the things that your book does really well is it uses surrealism to capture the feel of history on the ground. When you're involved in, like, huge historic events, but on the ground, you don't often really grok that. What you grok is that things are terrible around you. And I think that the way you paste together these nightmares is fascinating. Talk about creating each of these characters that you create.
Yeah, so it's Fujimori is one of the few real characters portrayed in the book. And I think, well, in Japanese, because his parents were Japanese immigrants, for some listeners, Fujimori was the president of Peru from 1990 till 2000. He won three elections. He won three elections fair and square, but he did leave the country as he began his third term because of corruption allegations and because the arrest of the head of his intelligence services, Montesinos, who is in prison in Peru today, that led to the collapse of his government. Fujimori is very interesting because the book doesn't center around Fujimori, but Fujimori does end the war. So in a sense, and even, you know, whatever one thinks of Fujimori, Fujimori has 50% approval in Peru and about 50% disapproval. It's pretty split. In the capital, though, however, he has significant support to the point that he can walk around now. He was jailed for many, many years when he came back to Peru from exile in Japan, where his parents were born. And he was released after multiple pardons, being sent back to prison, being released for one massacre, which was eventually like it's disputed of whether he was aware of it or not, because, you know, the country was in a state of war and no one really was aware of what was going on at all times. And he was also charged for smaller things to do with corruptions and influencing the press, these kind of matters. But Fujimori today, when he goes out to, you know, renew his identity card in Lima with his oxygen tank, he goes with, you know, maybe one or two bodyguards, and pretty much everybody comes up and asks him for a selfie, shakes his hand. He is not obviously, for those who lost family in the Peruvian Civil War, lasts from 1980 until 1992. Fujimori enters office in 1990. So for those who lost family, who were not members of the Shining Path insurgency during those 2 years, innocents who were lost either accidentally or, you know, targeted by certain members of the security forces, for those people, there is no forgiveness for Fujimori. But when he does walk in public, there is a, you can see that there is a, that the effect that he has is not of the Argentina military dictatorship, the Chilean military dictatorship, the Guatemala military dictatorship, where these groups orchestrated, you know, massive atrocities, the kidnapping of children, tens of thousands of people murdered, mass graves. And, you know, Peru under Fujimori was spared this. Fujimori, Alberto Fujimori, who has that kind of interesting thing where most Peruvians are of indigenous descent, Spanish and indigenous descent, or of mostly Spanish Moorish descent. So being of Indian descent like myself, or being of Japanese descent like Fujimori, it's a bit unusual, but it does exist. There are a couple of million Peruvians who are of Asian origin. And we have a Afro-Peruvian community, which is very prominent. Fujimori, kind of by entering office, he arms the peasantry. He arms the indigenous villages. He sets up patrols. He gives power to chiefs, and he says, the state is going to help you defend yourselves from this insurgency, which was led by intellectuals from the coast who were, you know, doing atrocities that cannot really be described in any format, whether visually or in literature, the kind of things they did to the most vulnerable Peruvians. But before Fujimori, in the two governments before him, the approach was essentially, oh, there's violence in the countryside, wipe it out. And you had soldiers go in, and there were countless atrocities committed against indigenous people, many of whom did not even speak Spanish. They did not understand why they were being targeted, first by the Shining Path, then suddenly by this army, which really was not present. This absent state was hurting them. So Fujimori and the atmosphere around him almost is like a character in the book, although they don't take up maybe too many pages of the book, because they set this shift in the country. They stopped the country from going off a cliff. The other characters that I've worked on, and this is not necessarily to create, I think there's a lot of attempts to sort of create sympathy for characters. I've tried very carefully in this book that there is no sympathy for anyone.
Interestingly, these people have sympathy for themselves. And I think that, you know, many of them think they're doing the right thing, or at least doing the least bad thing. Yeah. And I think that that's an interesting approach for a writer to take, to create characters whose actions we don't like, but we kind of want to like them, and they like themselves. And so that puts us in the uncomfortable position of liking characters whose actions are often abhorrent. And we realize that, you know, in similar circumstances, we might be capable of the same thing. That's, I think, the powerful message of this novel. It is summed up in an old Mothers of Invention song. It can't happen here. Yes, yeah. No, it can happen here. It is absolutely happening here.
Yeah, and you know, I think that when you're working with fiction, but at the same time, we're so caught up in, you know, actually looking at the histories of our countries and looking at, you know, the horrors of our countries and what they've done and what we've done to each other. There can be this kind of unease. Like, I thought sometimes when I was writing this, am I portraying Peru in a negative light? Am I showing this country as a country of, you know, barbarism? But so you stop doing that right away, because when you're writing literary fiction, your audience is so small and people are so into books that that is a very minor worry. It's not like you're having, you know, tens and tens of millions of people absorbing this. The days of Uncle Tom's Cabin or To Kill a Mockingbird influencing millions of people to see atrocities, that's over now, because you can just open your TikTok and you can see, or you can open Instagram, or you can open YouTube if you're not really into these things, like I'm not. You can open YouTube and you can see atrocities in real time. For the last few years, you can see it in real time. So there is no more need to use a book to teach people of atrocities, because we can document them. The people who are being harmed are documenting it themselves. People are showing it. People right now in Chiapas, they are showing the absence of the state on their phones, and they're showing what happens. Gazans are showing, Palestinians in the West Bank, they're showing people come into their homes, destroy their hospitals, take their doctors. They are documenting. Peru, when this was taking place, just like in many countries where this was taking place, whether it's Guatemala, whether it's the United States in the South, for 100 years of lynching after the Civil War, 100 years of the KKK after the Civil War, you know, African Americans could not, they could take photos in the aftermath, maybe, but we have such little imagery compared to what happened, compared to what has happened in the last few years. There's this big absence in all these atrocities. So when you try to capture it in literature, sometimes you kind of wonder, like, what's the purpose of doing this in the 21st century? But I think that it is still, you know, we need it, whether it's to give us clarity, whether it's to soothe ourselves, whether it's, as you said, to see ourselves and others, to see that if we are in a position where we're handed so much power, or our power is unchecked, what would we really do if someone wronged us, or we felt someone wronged us, or we want someone? And you see in this book that there's a member of the security services who has a deep desire for a woman, and he doesn't try to take her by force, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't harm women, he doesn't harm children, he doesn't go around harming innocent people, but he will harm one innocent person. Just one, after years and years of service, maybe just one, so he can get to her. And I think that that line, that's a very dangerous line. And that if we try to pretend that that line is in fiction only, we're fooling ourselves. We're soothing ourselves away from the real.
One of the things I found about this novel that I like so much was that your sensibility of, like, the grit and the hardness, and, you know, your surroundings, even though Peru is in many ways one of the most beautiful countries in the world and has many things to say, wonderful things to say about it, you do a really good job of, like, showing us, like, just how ground down everyday life can be, not just in Peru, but anywhere, really, because one of the things about this book is that the level of civilization and level of spread of civilization, which is from, you know, people living essentially, you know, as hunter-gatherers in the hills, and people living in 20th century, you know, splendor, sort of, in the cities, that there's a grittiness to every part of human life, and only our ability to see one another as fellow human beings and display compassion for one another as fellow human beings is what makes anything beautiful.
You put that very beautifully, and it's so important even in our how we use language, because we sometimes refer to, in Latin America, you'll hear a lot of references to the U.S., to Americans, but what people are referring to is to the U.S. government and to maybe certain U.S. soldiers, but the American people who, as you noted, you know, millions of Americans live in atrocious conditions and of all colors, and they are not connected to what is happening in politics. They don't even vote and they don't have much power. And their states have been, many of their states have been obliterated and many of their neighborhoods have been obliterated. And you don't see that. You may see it on a, you know, in a cop show. You may see it in some shows to show a little bit of grime, but to really dive into it and explore it, and I'm very privileged in Peru, so I can see Peru as a very beautiful country. I can, if I want to, I can only see the beauty of Peru. If you earn a couple of thousand US dollars a month, you can live in Peru and you can only see beautiful things. You can see the ocean, you can see, you know, grocery stores that have fruits and vegetables that you won't find in other countries, any country in the world. You can go into the mountains and you can be in peace, and there's so much beauty. But I think you have to make a special effort to, I want to go and, you know, I'm not just going to teach in these districts of Lima, I'm going to teach in these other districts of Lima, so that we can see what students are going through there. And that's quite shocking. That can be a big wake-up call. Certainly to people who've been very protected by their parents. I have not come from that kind of class, which is segregated from the rest of Peru. I don't come from that kind of money. But still, I still have to make an effort to be in provincias, to be in, you know, Cono Norte, to be in parts of the society that you don't really have to be part of, because the societies are heavily segregated. And it's not even now, and now the segregation, in the past it was, there was a heavy, heavy racial element. It is less racialized now because of the liberalization of the economy. You do see in private schools all colors, but a different kind of segregation exists, which you see in many countries in Global North, Global South. But the thing about the Shining Path insurgency and the way it drove millions of Peruvians out of the countryside in fear into the capital and created these pueblos jóvenes, these kind of shanty towns, it brought the reality of Peru to the face of the upper classes, of the middle classes, the small middle class, the small upper class. And you start to see, and I show this in the novel, of kind of you see things getting worse and worse, and the noose is kind of tightening around the power of Peru, where you start to see the water goes out, the electricity goes out, even in San Isidro, in La Molina. You see in good areas, they start to lose the things that kind of kept them in a developed state. And then that's when you start to see the professional class start to exit. And we've seen this time and time again in Latin America. We've seen this with Venezuela, we've seen this with Cuba. We've saw an exodus of intellectuals from Chile and Argentina. We've seen for so many years in the Middle East, this exodus. So I think that sometimes when a country fails to bridge this abyss, it's very dangerous, because eventually it will erupt. And if it doesn't erupt, because as you mentioned, the United States is kind of beyond first world, to the point where the country has become so militarized, and the police who are being killed, a police officer for 12 years in Peru was killed probably every day for 12 years by Centenero. We're speaking of a police officer maybe with a stick, or a police officer with a little pistol. You see in this country, the police are armed better than most armies. And so, How far can you take a system like that? And maybe you can take it to the end. It's possible to take it to the end and run your country like a military base, or run your country like an apartheid state. It's possible. But what does that do to your soul? What does that do to your heart? And that's something that I think we can't see in images. I think that's where the internality of literature comes in.
And well, that's a really important point you just made about the internality of literature. It's that reading is still an experience that cannot be equaled or exceeded by a film and stage. I think because the reader has to put in effort to take in the words. The words have to become part of you. And in the best literature, and this, and there are many scenes in your book that I will just never forget. You know, they'll be like, you know, I remember that nightmare.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because that's the effect that I wanted those images to, those written images, I guess, to stay with you.
Because I didn't knew so little about Peru, it was really interesting to read, see scenes where, you know, the shanty towns, the cities, even the jungles, these are all familiar scenes to me, but I knew nothing about the connective tissue of the history of Peru to put them together in the way I would in America. And one of the most striking things you write about are the Shining Path. I mean, that is a really incredible story. And it was interesting, you know, the way that Fujimori actually did manage to get them sort of under control. But I mean, the problem is that those emotions seem always present in humans, and that it only takes a couple years for something to, you know, plant it in the ground. We've solved that problem. It's going to show up again, because humans are, unfortunately, very human.
Yeah, and that's the thing about The Shining Path, was that, so first of all, there's a lot of, just take a little divergence here with The Shining Path, that there's a lot of Peruvian and Western historians, Peruvian and American mostly, and a few British historians, who tried to sort of explain The Shining Path. And as a historian, I can say that there is no legitimate explanation for The Shining Path, and I can explain why. Because we can explain why Sendero or Shining Path, why they spread so far, why 15, 20,000 lightly armed people using mostly dynamite or whatever weapons they could steal from police and soldiers, why they advanced so far, because Peru had an absent state. That's the explanation of how it can spread and get out of control. But in the 12 years before The Shining Path emerges, under the leadership of Abimael Guzman in Ayacucho in the south of Peru, a public university professor from the whitest city in Peru, Arequipa, who decided to come up a little bit and you know, mix this kind of indigenous Inca voodoo with Maoism and you know, socialism, and combine it and create his own, you know, he wrote a 400-page thesis on Kant and the universe. So this is the kind of person we're dealing with, someone who lives in their own reality and imposes their own reality. In the 12 years before The Shining Path begins burning ballot boxes and trying and starting its war with the Peruvian state, there was a socialist military government. And this socialist military government, while it didn't nationalize, you know, didn't nationalize my grandfather's camera shop, it didn't go that far, it didn't go into a full Fidel Castro mode, it created 200 state industries, it seized all the mines, it seized all the fisheries, it took over oil, it took over production of bread, it obliterated the land-owning class, because it did expropriation without compensation. There was not one penny given in exchange, and you ended up with indigenous Peruvians who were working the land, campesinos, who were living in a horrific state, under the thumb of a handful of families, each one ending up with 1 or 2 acres of land, some of it good, some of it not so good. Some areas were collectivized, some areas were not. And the owners and the top engineers, agriculture engineers, left the country or, you know, found a different way to earn a living. And this caused enormous problems, because the management class of the country, so this is the same problem you see in China under when Mao does his agrarian reform in China. When you obliterate that class and there's no planning and no one feels they have a stake, and everyone ends up with a very, very small parcel of land, or ends up having to share with people they don't even like, or a different village or whatnot, and you have state bureaucrats come and manage it and buy it and set the price, this is a disaster. And this while the agrarian reform was so important in Peru, Ironically, if there had not been an agrarian reform, it's likely that a group like Shining Path would have taken the country, because the peasantry would have felt no stake and would have felt so oppressed by their landlords, their overlords, that they would have maybe joined, or maybe they would have formed their own groups, because there were histories of small insurgencies in the past. But because Velasco, followed by Bermudez, did this reform, there was no more wealth in the countryside. And a country that was a poor country became a poverty-stricken country and became a desperately poor country. But these are not the people who joined the Shining Path. These are the people who were the victims of the Shining Path. The Shining Path begins to kill capitalinos and limeños and foreigners deeper into the 80s when they start to gain power. But the beginnings of the Shining Path, massacring indigenous communities, men, women, children, and then the military coming in and not knowing who's who, and not being able to catch these small groups of people and massacring back and killing more innocent people. So this is a terrifying thing when you see the Shining Path, because you can see how a small group of people can throw the country into complete chaos and cannot be explained so neatly, because there was already a series of reforms that other groups like the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, or, you know, Castro's group in Cuba, what they tried to advance had already been implemented by the state. So this makes things even more chilling, that people can do violence. And they're, you know, you can argue, oh, it's for discrimination. They didn't really have any, when they left the university, there really wasn't much for them to do. There wasn't a proper economy, or there wasn't a proper cultural sector. Sure, you can make all those arguments, but there's a big breach between doing that and killing dogs and hanging them from lampposts and making allusions to this being somehow tied to the destruction of Maoism, that these dogs symbolize the dogs who betrayed Mao by making China capitalistic. That's a very strange thing, and you can and I've studied it for years and years and years, and you can go and I've been to the south of Peru and I've spoken about it, and if you want to explain, if someone tells you they can explain the Shining Path, you know, I don't know what to say to a person who says that.
Madness is always a madness. You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting about your book was, this is a book about people who are caught in the worst of circumstances, making so many extremely bad decisions. And many of your characters are students, teachers, scholars, university presidents. Talk about the import of education and the educational mindset, either one who seeks to be educated or seeks to provide education or at least work in that environment. Talk about the import of that in this novel and how it plays out.
Yeah. So there's two things there. So there's exactly that. You have public universities set up in the 20th century, not early 20th century, deeper in, not set up per se, but expanded to include more people. And you have professors who are getting their training either in, you know, a university that's very politicized, or going abroad to China, going abroad to France, and bringing back, you know, the ideas that were in fashion. And then teaching them to first generation university students who live in a very impoverished society, and who maybe they're able to get an education, but they're by no means prosperous. And you fill them with these ideas, and maybe if the person has charisma or is amicable, and they don't have that kind of figure in their life to admire, you can look at the same thing with the cartels or with gangs in different countries. You look to these people for guidance, and you'll do what they say. And many don't. Most don't. Most students do not have anything to do with the Shining Path. Most students are running away from the Shining Path or fleeing their universities because they found out that they were having these meetings where they were planning violence. That created a very big problem in Peru. And what did Peru know of what was going on in China? There was no television in most of the country. There was hardly radio in most of the country, but reading a report of what was done in Peking or in Beijing, it's not like today where you can actually see people come from China investing and tell you how their system is, and you can go travel to these countries and see what their system is like. This was absent. You're teaching people ideas, not realities. You're not showing them a reality. There's no way to document it and to bring it to them. Another thing is that, and funnily enough, that the Shining Path emerges from universities, because most incredible movements in Latin America, good movements, have emerged in universities. And you see right now in Mexico and in the United States and in Peru and in Panama, incredible activism from students, whether it's for the environment, whether it's to kick out a Canadian mine in Panama that was going to wipe out the clean water supply, whether it's students at the UNAM in Mexico City or students in California, in New York, being dragged and arrested because they're protesting against their government's human rights abuses in Palestine. You see so much of this goodness come from the universities. And even in the case of Nicaragua, where you saw the overthrow of the Somoza regime and you see the Sandinistas come into power, whatever the Sandinistas have become in their autocracy in Nicaragua, the students received this movement from the countryside, and they assembled a proper society, students, business people, teachers, doctors. This is not the case of what happened in Peru. Peru is an anomaly in this case, and that's what makes for good fiction. We don't want to repeat the same thing. We want to look for the strangeness, and that's the strangeness of maybe Cambodia and Peru, where you see these very horrific movements emerge from a handful of rural universities. But there's one more thing here. Beyond the importation of these dangerous ideologies and the inability to verify if these words are true, because you're either not you haven't been reading for a long time, or you haven't had access to these real images, real statistics, we sometimes think that by reading or by writing, we are more decent. And I love to read and write, and reading is my first love, and that's of those two. But reading, I find, is like exercise and like maybe dieting. You know, I can eat I drink my little green smoothies full of the good stuff to stay healthy, and I go for my runs, and we all try to do something for ourselves. But does exercising and eating right make you a more decent person? It makes you a healthier person, might make you a stronger person, might make you live longer. Reading can soothe you, and it can give you clarity, and it can make you feel more alive. It can let you see more, learn more. But does it make you more decent? And that's something you see this cliche that, oh, reading teaches empathy. I don't know about that. Barack Obama wrote a pretty good book in 1995, pretty great novel, pretty great memoir, Dreams from My Father. I have it. It's very, very well written. And you can go online right now, and he's got all his ghostwritten books, and you can go look at you can go type in Obama drone victims' children, and you can go see them. You can go see how they were burned and how they received treatment in other countries. And he saw all of this, and he had access to all of this. So at the highest level, people who we admire for their eloquence, and we admire for their ability to write and to explore and take from different ideas and take from different ideologies, and they commit, unspeakable atrocities that cannot be explained in words, that, again, then we drift back into madness. So, and you can go to any regime in history, and they're very well-read dictators everywhere, and they're very, very well-read insurgencies everywhere. So there's the importation of bad ideologies, but even if there wasn't, even if it was just homegrown stuff, does reading and writing and studying make you more decent? Does it really make you kinder to others? I meet a lot of really kind people who are, they're functionally literate maybe, but they don't like to read, and they don't read much. And you can't meet nicer people than that. My brother has autism, and he can't read a literary fiction novel, but you won't find someone more unwilling to do harm
One of the things about this book I think that's so interesting is the overall narrative flow, in that you kind of pass us from one perspective to another, and sometimes it's almost unclear. And this reminds me a bit of a dream kind of narrative where we jump and lurch. And the thing about those kind of narratives is, and the import of dreams themselves, is they teach us something about reality. We, as humans, we like a good story. We like a beginning, middle, and end. And we will impose that story on events that have no beginning, no middle, and unfortunately, no end. That's one of the things about this book. You really capture that kind of feel of the way that chance and luck, mostly bad luck, will, you know, steer a life.
Yeah, and I think I look for in my life sometimes, we look for finality, that I will achieve this and I will be happy. Or I will, you know, we will put an end to the shining path and we can coast off of that victory for another 30 years and do nothing for the development of the country. It applies in a small way and it applies in micro ways, you can look at that. And yeah, life's not like that. And countries are not like that, and empires are not. I think that when I write, I'm very careful to make the book still accessible, in that line by line, I don't want someone else. I hear a lot of the term of an experimental novel, and I kind of cringe when I hear that, because there are a lot of experimental novels where the author seems to be doing it to show off, or they're doing it for themselves. Like, how on earth could I possibly know you're writing from the perspective of, like, I don't know, the dog, or the perspective of this unnamed character who introduced 200 pages. And that's kind of like, I guess some people like that. They like to be in a state of total confusion. I don't like that as a reader. So I try on a line by line level, or at least on a section by section level, to give you a little bit of a sense of place. But to your point that, like, that there is beginning, middle, and end, like, no way, because that not only would it be like, you know, who wants to read the 500,000th book that has that structure? I don't want to be producing another copy of that. But also, I think it's also more interesting for people to realize that, oh yeah, that's true, because the good times don't last, and the bad times also hopefully don't always last either. And for parts of your society, the bad times always last, and for parts of your society, the good times always last. It really depends.
You know, it interests me that you're a historian and that you turned out a novel that, in a sense, is kind of almost anti-historic.
So I love reading history. I love studying history. You know, I like to go to my museums and go to my archives. And, you know, most of my family is in Peru and Panama, and the archives are not in great state. But I still go through them. And it's, you know, it's a disturbing process sometimes. Again, it's not as disturbing as the images we see today. So I think that whatever kind of nightmares you have from those archives, they kind of, as life goes on, you look out at screens and you see that things are much worse. And we found new ways to hurt each other, which is incredible. But yeah, I think when you, for me at least, when I did so much, looked at history so much, I found myself kind of abandoning history a little bit, because it could be like, maybe it's because I got frustrated with like the neatness of trying to categorize, oh, the shining path is in such a category, or you hear this expression, Fujimori destroyed the institutions of Peru. And I'm like, you know, go on Wikipedia and look at all of the military coups we've had in Peru and look at all the different political parties. There was no institutionality in Peru, but that myth is parroted by historians in Harvard and La Católica and Lima. It's parroted by historians in Spain. You hear these kind of, they're almost like myths. And I find that's not just the case with Peru. That's the case with many countries where either you blame certain events on certain people, or you attribute the faults of your country to one person, or the ICC issues a warrant for one person when they'd have to issue millions of warrants for all the people who are complicit in something. And I think that kind of, that after years of that, and also teaching history also, you get asked a lot of questions when you teach kids history, or when you teach, I've taught in some prisons as well, and you teach, whether you're teaching kids or adults, they ask you questions that you can answer. And a university accept the answer, and maybe even a society would accept the answer, but it's not correct. And you're trying to find, you're seeking clarity so much that you've ended up creating little boxes that you can check to make yourself feel good. And I couldn't do that. I didn't want to write another book about the history of Peru that, and how can one historian really tell you the whole history of a country? The experiences of some groups in the south of Peru versus other groups under the Shining Path, it's very different. And some parts of the country were untouched by the terrorism, and they were not as affected by the inflation. So how can you encompass their experiences? So it's safer to work in fiction. It's safer to work in fiction because one does not pretend. And unfortunately, you see a lot of novelists go around thinking that I'm the voice of my country, or I'm the voice of the society, and they think that their novel somehow is a qualifier. That it's not. I think fiction is a good place to work with these ideas and to acknowledge I'm doing this for you, the reader. I'm not doing this to be the authority.
Well, too, I know, like this points out that the facts only go so far. It's the feelings and the internal experiences of the people who experience those facts that really create the whole feel of the situation. So you have like a fellow who is, you know, obsessed with a woman, he kind of follows her around and steers himself into her orbit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you read this, his internal experience, you think, well, you know, he's in love, he's doing kind of the right thing. But, I mean, the facts and that what he's surrounded by is, you know, at best, god-awful.
Yeah.
So talk, you know, about the importance of using the internal emotions and perspectives of your characters to underlie, you know, rather unpleasant facts.
Yeah. 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 How we see ourselves in the story we've written for ourselves, if we're lucky, because a lot of people are taken care of, and they don't have that autonomy. Whether you're temporarily injured or you're disabled or you know, you're very small, you don't really have control over your own story. But for those of us who are privileged to have it, even if things are very bad around us, there's a limit to how much we. There's a limit to how much we can sort of look to others and look outwards. We naturally end up looking inwards for our own satisfaction, or at least even in a positive way, to assuage our own guilt. And I think that the main bulk of the story the main bulk of the novel is this member of the security services. And he, after the war is over, he becomes a teacher, and he takes off his uniform and goes to teaching because he knows that, or he puts on a more standard uniform and pretends to be a more like National Guard kind of person because he knows that there can be consequences for the things he's done, or not even the things he's done, simply to cast a wide net over everyone and that's the truth that, you know, the vast majority of members of the Peruvian security officials fighting the Shining Path, many of them committed no atrocities and no crimes. unlike in Argentina, where you know they you know almost everyone committed almost everyone in the military committed atrocities. That's not the case in a country like Peru. So that makes things more complicated, because today, or even after Fujimori left the country, there was an attempt to say, okay, we're going to go after everyone who was part of that administration. And that's a very that's a way to break a society, because you create an idea that if you were doing your duty and you did not commit atrocities and you did not rape and you did not do extrajudicial killings and you went by the book, why should you all be persecuted? That creates a lot of resentment, and that resentment and leaving a bunch of men with resentment and access to weapons is a dangerous thing. It is a very dangerous thing. The first thing the Americans did when they came into Iraq was they told the Iraqi soldiers, you're done. You have no more paycheck. You're over now. Get out of here. And certainly Iraqi soldiers, many of them under Saddam Hussein, committed atrocities. But many were soldiers who were on the borders of their country. And you've taken away their livelihood and their dignity and their rank. And what do you expect to happen? What logically would you expect? So in the novel, I don't try to go and do a whole synopsis of all of the different stories. I focus on a few people. And one of the security agents, I don't know if he becomes a teacher because he wants to assuage his guilt of the bad thing he did to get this woman, to get someone out of the way to get this woman. Or did he do it because he's just a decent guy who did something wrong? Knowingly wrong, and he's not guilty about it, and he just did something wrong because I'm a human being, I do wrong things, I did all these other good things, so I deserve a treat. So maybe he operates, and that's the thing, that it's the freedom of you to interpret that. Maybe he's just a person who goes from some people think about their life in a way where, okay, I'm this person and I'm doing this, and this is my vision, and this is my idea of myself, and this is what I want to accomplish. And some people are not like that. Some people go from day to day, task to task, fulfillment to fulfillment. And I leave it to you of what kind of person you'd like him to be.
No, also, this novel points out, indirectly, one of the things that I like about this novel is that you don't, as they say in Mad Magazine, wear your sausage on your sleeve. this novel points out decades, maybe centuries, of bad American foreign policy, which is to say, we have no policy in South America. It's the closest. It's a giant chunk of land. It's filled with amazing resources, amazing people, amazing countries. And we just go, huh? Huh?
Yep. Yeah, there's not much curiosity. Yeah.
And it seems to me that, a lot of the terrible things that have happened in South America could have been prevented or at least modified slightly if America had been paying attention and thought, well, this is part of where we live too. Not just, we don't just live in America and Iraq. We live, there's a huge continent just down around the corner there that could use some attention.
Yeah. And I think that there have been moments where some administrations have their way of giving attention has been to do a coup or to shove their company into basically make their companies the government, United Fruit. You still see it with you still see it right now in Honduras, where a U.S. government backed American line is basically trying to take the government of Honduras to court for the equivalent of its GDP or half of its GDP. And lock it in a process of arbitration and squeeze the country because it won't allow it to build. It's not even a mine or anything, just to have a zone which is independent of Honduras in Honduras. And so this is the kind of attention that, you want this, my donors, the Democratic Party, Republican Party, you want this in Honduras, you want this in Peru, we'll squeeze them so that you get it. that seems to be the attention. There were moments where the U.S. government tried to provide aid to alleviate poverty, in the idea that this would prevent, whether it would prevent their companies from being kicked out, or whether it would at least prevent mass migration. And this has not worked because, first of all, you can't really, throwing money at a country doesn't help. What really helps is either you support that country, and that support doesn't mean that you pick the government of the country and you say, who's my friend who's going to run your country? No, it's that lift the embargo on Cuba. Certainly the Cuban government has been a disastrous administrator of Cuba. No, I would not want to be a young person in Cuba trying to get a book published. If it was difficult in Peru or Canada, the US to do that, it's almost impossible in Cuba. But let people see. Let people have access to their imports. Let their family be able to come visit them. Alleviate in that sense. Don't try to squeeze people because you have a rift with them, and then go around to countries that are far worse and are led by much more atrocious people like Saudi Arabia or the Israeli regime and give them whatever they want. It doesn't make any sense. There has to be a consistency that you're not trying to pick and choose sides. Pick and choose sides that these guys will do what I want so they can kill whoever they want. And I will look the other way and we'll come visit them, and they can come to the White House, and they can come to the Elysee Palace, and they can come to Buckingham Palace, and they can hang out. That's not how you should treat each other. And that sounds very corny, like how we should treat each other. It's very like moralizing, maybe, because like people see it as a business. Like, yeah, there's a group of people in the United States who don't want to normalize relations with Cuba, so we're not going to do it because it's business. It's bad for business, for our business. And that's one way to live in the world, definitely. The situation, though, as we see, is that the United States has become Latin America. The United States is becoming slowly and steadily Latin America, in that it was one thing to put sanctions on individual members of the Venezuelan government who committed atrocities against protesters. It's quite another thing to prevent the importation of diapers and the importation and the sale of oil. That's quite another thing. And now you have hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans in desperate situation living in the United States, fleeing into the United States, because this is the country that has an enormous economy and has been a developed economy for, you know, a couple of hundred years now. And so there's a base to provide employment. And in Central America, the United States government gave a free check to the military regime in El Salvador, in Guatemala, to massacre the peasantry. And now you can find El Salvadoreños and Guatemaltecos, you find them all over the United States. And they're living here. And that's madness. That's madness, because you see also now, I'll tell you another thing. I do a little bit of volunteer work for Heal Palestine. And you have kids coming now into the United States being treated in American hospitals who've been amputated, they've lost their legs, their hands, they've lost their families, they've been burned. They're being treated by very decent American doctors and by very decent American nurses, and being taken into homes by Americans of all backgrounds, Arab American and non-Arab American. They're being treated in the country which has inflicted this on them. That to me seems like madness. And you go to Paterson, New Jersey, and it's full of Peruvians. It's with hundreds of thousands of Peruvians. And a lot of the immigrants from Peru, they left during the 80s when the country was in collapse, which was really, the United States was not involved in the collapse of Peruvian society. The United States was not involved in the Shining Path. In combating, I fictionalized that a little bit in the book. The United States really was not involved in helping the Peruvian government combat the Shining Path. But when Fujimori comes into power and he starts to apply certain measures, which are, you know, difficult measures, measures we don't all like, and that are not they don't suit our tastes if we want to be in a democratic kind of a society. And the United States immediately was wagging its finger at him and saying, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. You got to respect human rights. Well, the 10 years before him, the government was massacring the indigenous population in an attempt to wipe out the Shining Path. He's trying to implement, whether you agree with it or not, he's trying to implement a different policy. And the United States government is wagging its finger at it. That's very strange. And when Fujimori ends the war, allows American investors to come into the country, country's doing well. Certainly he's autocratic. Certainly he has a lot of the media in his pocket. A guy named Alejandro Toledo, who's indigenous Peruvian, trained at University of San Francisco, with U.S. backing, has organized his mass protests, and they push Fujimori out of the country. And during Toledo's government, that was an American government of Peru. They did whatever the United States wanted. So this idea to pretend that the United States is concerned, the U.S. government, let's be very clear, the United States government is concerned of how these countries rise and fall. They're not. They're concerned at the moment, or for the last, 100 years, with how their donors feel about what's happening in certain countries where they have their enterprises, or a fear of the American electorate of how they will react. Because the business class of America wants mass immigration from Latin America. They want them to work the fields. They want them in their factories. They want them to staff their enterprises. But a lot of the population doesn't. A lot of the anti-immigrant population does not. And you need your votes. So you crack down on that and you try to stave it off. This is a very, very, and that's why the United States is becoming, like the United States was partially, used to be part, a large part of the US was part of Mexico. So now you're seeing, this Latinization of the United States. And it's been going on for quite some time. And I don't know if it's going to be a good thing or not. I don't know if people, because just because someone comes from a certain origin, again, it doesn't make them more compassionate. I don't know what will be the future in that sense. If this kind of U.S. erratic policy you described kind of continues.
The new novel by Avik Jain is "This Country Is No Longer Yours." He's talking about Peru, but could be your country. Thank you for joining me, Avik.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.